As soon as Odin had completed his stately hobble to the bathroom floor, two nurses hurried in and stripped and remade the bed with immense precision, patting down the fresh linen, pulling it taut, turning it and tucking it. One of the nurses, clearly the senior, was plump and matronly, the other younger, darker and more generally bird-like. The newspaper was whisked off the floor and neatly refolded. The floor was briskly hoovered, the curtains hooked back, the flowers and the untouched fruit replaced with fresh flowers and fresh fruit that would, like every piece of fruit before them, remain untouched. When, after a little while, the old god's morning ablutions had been completed and the bathroom door reopened, the room had been transformed. The actual differences were tiny, of course, but the effect was of a subtle but magical transformation into something cool and fresh. Odin nodded in quiet satisfaction to see it. He made a little show of inspecting the bed, like a monarch inspecting a line of soldiers. "Is it well tucked?" he asked in his old and whispery voice. "It is very well tucked, Mr. Odwin," said the senior nurse with an obsequious beam. "Is it neatly turned?" It clearly was. This was merely a ritual. "Turned very neatly indeed, Mr. Odwin," said the nurse. "I supervise the turning down of the sheets myself."
"I'm very glad of that, Sister Bailey. Very glad," said Odin. "You have a fine eye for a trimly turned fold. It alarms me to know what I shall do without you."
"Well, I'm not about to go anywhere, Mr. Odwin," said Sister Bailey, oozing happy reassurance.
"But you won't last for ever, Sister Bailey," said Odin. It was a remark that puzzled Sister Bailey on the time she'd heard it, because of its apparent extreme callousness.
"Sure, and none of us last for ever, Mr. Odwin," she said gently, as she and the other nurse between them managed the difficult task of lifting Odin back into bed while keeping his dignity intact.
"You're Irish, aren't you, Sister Bailey?" he asked, once he was properly settled.
"I am indeed so, Mr. Odwin. Knew an Irishman once, Finn something. Told me a lot of stuff I didn't need to know. Never told me about the linen. Still, I know now."
He nodded curtly at this memory, and lowered his head stiffly back onto the firmly plumped-up pillows, and ran the back of his finely freckled hand over the folded-back linen sheet. Quite simply, he was in love with linen. Clean, lightly starched, white, Irish linen, pressed, folded, tucked. The words themselves were almost a litany of desire for him. In centuries nothing had obsessed him or moved him so much as a linen did now. He could not for the life of him understand how he could ever have cared for anything else. Linen and sleep. Sleep and linen. Sleep in linen. Sleep. Sister Bailey regarded him with a sort of proprietary fondness. She did not know that he was a god as such. In fact, she thought he was probably an old film producer or Nazi war criminal. Certainly, he had an accent which she couldn't quite place, and his careless civility, his natural selfishness, and his obsession with personal hygiene spoke of a past that was rich with horrors. If she could have been transported to where she might see her secretive patient enthroned, warrior father of the warrior gods of Asgard, she would not have been surprised. That is not quite true, in fact. She would have been startled quite out of her wits, but she would at least have recognized that it was consistent with the qualities she perceived in him, once she had recovered from the shock of discovering that virtually everything the human race had ever chosen to believe in was true, or that it continued to be true long after the human race particularly needed it to be true any more. Odin dismissed his medical attendants with a gesture, having first asked for his personal assistant to be found and sent to him once more. This caused Sister Bailey to tighten her lips just a very little. She did not like Mr. Odin's personal assistant, general factotum, manservant, call him what you will. His eyes were malevolent, he made her jump, and she strongly suspected him of making unspeakable suggestions to his nurses during their tea breaks. He had what Sister Bailey supposed was what people meant by an olive complexion, in that it was extraordinarily close to being green. Sister Bailey was convinced that it was not right at all. She was, of course, the last person to judge somebody by the colour of their skin. Or, if not absolutely the last, she had at least done it as recently as yesterday afternoon, when an African diplomat had been brought in to have some gallstones removed, and she had conceived an instant resentment of him. She didn't like him. She couldn't say exactly what it was she didn't like about him, because she was a nurse, not a taxi driver, and she wouldn't let her personal feelings show for an instant. She was much too professional, much too good at her job, and treated everyone with a more or less equal, efficient and cheerful courtesy. Even, she thought, and a profound iciness settled on her at this point, even Mr. Ragg. Mr. Ragg was the name of Mr. Odwin's personal assistant. There was nothing she could do about it. It was not her place to criticise Mr. Odwin's personal arrangements. But if it had been her business, which it wasn't, then she would greatly have preferred it, and not just for herself, but for Mr. Odwin's own well-being as well, which was the important thing, if he could have employed someone who didn't give her the absolute heebie-jeebies. That was all. She thought no more about it, merely went to look for him. She had been relieved to discover when she came on duty this morning that Mr. Ragg had left the premises the previous night, but had then, with a keen sense of disappointment, spotted him returning about an hour or so ago. She found him exactly where he was not supposed to be. He was squatting on one of the seats in the visitors' waiting room, wearing what looked horribly like a soiled and discarded doctor's gown that was much too big for him. Not only that, but he was playing a thinly unmusical tune on a sort of pipe that he had obviously carved out of a large disposable hypodermic syringe, which he absolutely should not have had. He glanced up at her with his quick, dancing eyes, grinned, and continued to tootle and squeak, only significantly louder. Sister Bailey ran through in her mind all the things that it was completely pointless to say about either the coat or the syringe, or about him being in the visitor's room, frightening or preparing to frighten the visitors. She knew she wouldn't be able to stand the air of injured innocence with which he would reply, or the preposterous absurdity of his answers. Her only course was simply to let it pass and just get him away from the room and out of the way as quickly as possible. "Mr. Odwin would like to see you," she said. She tried to jam some of her normal lilting quality into her voice, but it just wouldn't go. She wished his eyes would stop dancing like that. Apart from finding it highly disturbing from both a medical and aesthetic point of view, she also could not help but be piqued by the impression it conveyed that there were at least 37 things in the room more interesting than her. He gazed at her in this disconcerting manner for a few seconds, then, muttering that there was no peace for the wicked, not even the extremely wicked, he pushed past Sister Bailey and skedaddled up the corridor to receive instructions from his lord and master, quickly, before his lord and master fell asleep. By the end of the morning, Kate had discharged herself from hospital. There were some initial difficulties involved in this, because first the ward sister and then the doctor in charge of Kate's case were adamant that she was in no fit state to leave. She had only just emerged from a minor coma, and she needed care, she needed... "Pizza," insisted Kate. "Rest, she needed. My own home and fresh air. The air in here is horrible. It smells like a vacuum cleaner's armpit. Further medication, and should definitely remain under observation for another day or so, until they were satisfied that she had made a full recovery." At least, they were fairly adamant. During the course of the morning, Kate demanded and got a telephone, and started trying to order pizza to be delivered to her ward. She phoned around all of the least cooperative pizza restaurants she knew in London, harangued them, then made some noisily unsuccessful attempts to muster a motorbike, to roam around the West End, and try and pick up for her an American hot with a list of additional peppers and mushrooms and cheeses, which the controller of the courier service refused even to attempt to remember. And after an hour or so of this sort of behaviour, the objections to Kate discharging herself from the hospital gradually fell away like petals from an autumn rose. And so, a little after lunchtime, she was standing on a bleak West London street, feeling weak and shaky, but in charge of herself. She had with her the empty, tattered remains of the garment bag, which she had refused to relinquish, and also a small scrap of paper in her purse, which had a single name scribbled on it. She hailed a taxi and sat in the back with her eyes closed most of the way back to her home in Primrose Hill. She climbed up the stairs and let herself into her top-floor flat. There were 10 messages on her answering machine, which she simply erased without listening to. She threw open the window in her bedroom, and for a moment or two leaned out of it at the rather dangerous and awkward angle which allowed her to see a patch of the park. It was a small corner patch, with just a couple of plane trees standing in it. The backs of some of the intervening houses framed it, or rather, just failed totally to obscure it, and made it very personal and private to Kate, in a way which a vast, sweeping vista would not have been. On one occasion, she had gone to this corner of the park, and walked around the invisible perimeter that marked off the limits of what she could see, and had come very close to feeling that this was her own domain. She had even patted the plane trees in a proprietorial sort of way, and had then sat beneath them, watching the sun going down over London, over its badly spoiled skyline and its non-delivering pizza restaurants, and had come away with a profound sense of something or other, though she wasn't quite certain what. Still, she had told herself, these days she should feel grateful for a profound sense of anything at all, however unspecific. She hauled herself in from the window, left it wide open in spite of the chill of the outside air, padded through into the small bathroom and ran the bath. It was a bath of the sprawling Edwardian type, which took up a wonderfully disproportionate amount of the space available, and encompassed most of the rest of the room with cream-painted pipes. The taps seethed. As soon as the room was sufficiently full of steam to be warm, Kate undressed, and then went and opened the large bathroom cupboard. She felt faintly embarrassed by the sheer profusion of things she had for putting in baths, but she was, for some reason, incapable of passing any chemist or herb shop without going in to be subduced by some glass-stoppered bottle of something blue or green or orange and oily that was supposed to restore the natural balance of some vague substance she didn't even know she was supposed to have in her paws. She paused, trying to choose. Something pink? Something with extra vitamin B? Vitamin B12? B13? Just the number of things with different types of vitamin B in them was an embarrassment of choice in itself. There were powders, as well as oils, tubes of gel, even packets of some kind of pungent-smelling seed that was meant to be good for some obscure part of you in some arcane way. How about some of the green crystals? One day, she had told herself in the past, she would not even bother trying to choose, but would simply put a bit of everything in, when she really felt in need of it. She rather thought that today was the day, and with a sudden reviving rush of pleasure, she set about putting a drop or two of everything in the cupboard into the seething bath, until it was confused with mingling, muddying colours and verging on the glutinous to touch. She turned off the taps, went to her handbag for a moment, then returned and lowered herself into the bath, where she lay with her eyes closed, breathing slowly for fully 3 minutes, before at last turning her attention to the scrap of paper she had brought with her from the hospital. It had one word on it, and it was a word she had dragged out of an oddly reluctant young nurse who had taken her temperature that morning. Kate had questioned her about the big man whom she had encountered at the airport, whose body she had seen in a nearby side ward in the early hours of the night. "Oh, no," the nurse had said. "He wasn't dead. He was just in a sort of coma." Could she see him? Kate had asked. What was his name? She had tried to ask idly, in passing, as it were, which was a difficult trick to pull off with a thermometer in her mouth, and she wasn't at all certain she had succeeded. The nurse had said that she couldn't really say. She wasn't really meant to talk about other patients. And anyway, the man wasn't there anymore. He'd been taken somewhere else. They had sent an ambulance to collect him and take him somewhere else. This had taken Kate considerably by surprise. Where had they taken him? What was this special place? But the nurse had been unwilling to say anything much more, and a second or two later had been summoned away by the sister. The only word the nurse had said was the one that Kate had then scribbled down on the piece of paper she was now looking at. The word was Woodshead. Now that she was more relaxed, she had a feeling that the name was familiar to her in some way, though she could not remember where she had heard it. The instant she remembered, she could not stay in the bath any longer, but got out and made straight for the telephone, pausing only briefly to shower all the gunk off her. The big man awoke and tried to look up, but could hardly raise his head. He tried to sit up, but couldn't do that either. He felt as if he'd been stuck to the floor with superglue, and after a few seconds he discovered the most astounding reason for this. He jerked his head up violently, yanking out great tufts of yellow hair which stayed painfully stuck to the floor, and looked around him. He was in what appeared to be a derelict warehouse, probably an upper floor, judging from the wintry sky he could see creeping past the grimy, shattered windows. The ceilings were high, and hung with cobwebs built by spiders who did not seem to mind that most of what they caught was crumbling plaster and dust. They were supported by pillars made from upright steel joists, on which the dirty old cream paint was bubbled and flaking, and these in turn stood on a floor of battered old oak, onto which he had clearly been glued. Extending out for a foot or two in a rough oval all around his naked body, the floor glistened darkly and dully. Thin, nostril-cleaning fumes rose from it. He could not believe it. He roared with rage, tried to wriggle and shake himself, but succeeded only in tugging painfully at his skin where it was stuck fast to the oak planks. This had to be the old man's doing. He threw his head back hard against the floor in a blow that cracked the boards and made his ears sing. He roared again and took some furious satisfaction in making as much hopeless, stupid noise as he could. He roared until the steel pillars rang and the cracked remains of the windows shattered into finer shards. Then, as he threw his head angrily from one side to the other, he caught sight of his sledgehammer leaning against the wall a few feet from him, heaved it up into the air with a word, and sent it hurtling around the great space, beating and clanging on every pillar until the whole building reverberated like a mad gong. Another word, and the hammer flew back at him, missed his head by hand's width, and punched straight down through the floor, shattering the wood and the plaster below. In the darker space beneath him, the hammer spun, and swung round in a slow, heavy parabola, as bits of plaster fell about it and rattled on the concrete floor below. Then it gathered a violent momentum and hurtled back up through the ceiling, smacking up a stack of startled splinters as it punched through another oak floorboard a hand's width from the soles of the big man's feet. It soared up into the air, hung there for a moment as if its weight had suddenly vanished. Then, deftly flicking its short handle up above its head, it drove hard back down through the floor again, then up again, then down again, punching holes in a splintered ring around its master, until, with a long, heavy groan, the whole oval section of punctured floor gave way and plunged, twisting through the air. It shattered itself against the floor below, amidst a rain of plaster debris, from which the figure of the big man then emerged staggering, flapping at the dusty air and coughing, his back, His arms and his legs were still covered with great splintered hunks of oak flooring, but at least he was able to move. He leant the flat of his hands against the wall and violently coughed some of the dust from his lungs. As he turned back, his hammer danced out of the air towards him, then suddenly evaded his grasp and skidded joyfully off across the floor, striking sparks from the concrete with its great head, flipped up, and parked itself against a nearby pillar at a jaunty angle. In front of him, the shape of a large Coca-Cola vending machine loomed through the settling cloud of dust. He regarded it with the gravest suspicion and worry. It stood there with a sort of glazed, blank look to it, and had a note from his father stuck on the front panel, saying whatever he was doing, stop it. It was signed You Know Who, but this had been crossed out, and first the word Odin, and then in large letters, Your Father, had been substituted. Odin never ceased to make absolutely clear his view of his son's intellectual accomplishments. The big man tore the note off and stared at it in anger. A postscript added darkly, Remember Wales, you don't want to go through all that again. He screwed the note up and hurled it out of the nearest window, where the wind whipped it up and away. For a moment he thought he heard an odd squeaking noise, but it was probably just the blustering of the wind as it whistled between the nearby derelict buildings. He turned and walked to the window, and stared out of it in a belligerent sulk. Glued to the floor, at his age, what the devil was that supposed to mean? Keep your head down, was what he guessed. If you don't keep it down, I'll have to keep it down for you. That was what it meant. Stick to the ground. He remembered now the old man saying exactly that to him at the time of all the unpleasantness with the Phantom fighter jet. Why can't you just stick to the ground, he had said. He could imagine the old man in his soft-headed, benign malice, thinking it very funny to make the lesson so literal. Rage began to rumble menacingly inside him, but he pushed it down hard. Very worrying things had recently begun happening when he got angry, and he had a bad feeling, looking back at the Coca-Cola vending machine, that another of those very worrying things must have just happened. He stared at it and fretted. He felt ill. He had felt ill a lot of late, and he found it impossible to discharge what were left of his godly duties when he felt he was suffering from a sort of continual low-grade flu. He experienced headaches, dizzy spells, guilt, and all the sorts of ailments that were featured so often in television advertisements. He even suffered terrifying blackouts whenever the great rage gripped him. He always used to have such a wonderful time getting angry. Great gusts of marvellous anger would hurl him through life. He felt huge. He felt flooded with power and light and energy. He had always been provided with such wonderful things to get angry about. Immense acts of provocation or betrayal, people hiding the Atlantic Ocean in his helmet, dropping continents on him or getting drunk and pretending to be trees, stuff he could really work up a rage about and hit things. In short, he had felt good about being a thunder god. Now suddenly it was headaches, nervous tension, nameless anxieties and guilt. These were new experiences for a god and not pleasant ones. You look ridiculous! The voice screeched out and affected Thor like fingernails scratched across a blackboard lodged in the back of his brain. It was a mean voice, a spiteful, jeering voice, a cheap white nylon shirt of a voice, a shiny trousered pencil moustache of a voice, in short, which Thor did not like. He reacted very badly to it at the best of times, and was particularly provoked to have to hear it while standing naked in the middle of a decrepit warehouse with large sections of an oak floor still stuck to his back. He spun round angrily. He wanted to be able to turn round calmly and with crushing dignity, but no such strategy ever worked with this creature. And since he, Thor, would only end up feeling humiliated and ridiculous whatever posture he adopted, he might as well go with one he felt comfortable with. Torag! He roared, yanked his hammer spinning into the air and hurled it with immense stunning force at the small creature who was squatting complacently in the shadows on top of a small heap of rubble, leaning forward a little. Torag caught the hammer and placed it neatly on top of the pile of Thor's clothes that lay next to him. He grinned, and allowed a stray shaft of sunlight to glitter on one of his teeth. These things don't happen by accident. Torag had spent some time while Thor was unconscious, working out how long it would take him to recover, then industriously moving the pile of rubble to exactly the spot, checking the height, and then calculating the exact angle at which to lean. As a provocateur, he regarded himself as a professional. "Did you do this to me?" roared Thor. "Did you?" Thor searched for any way of saying, "gloomy to the floor." That didn't sound like gloomy to the floor, but eventually the pause got too long and he had to give it up. "Gloomy to the floor?" he demanded at last. He wished he hadn't asked such a stupid question. "Don't even answer that," he added angrily, and wished he hadn't said that either. He stamped his foot and shook the foundations of the building a little just to make the point. He wasn't certain what the point was, but he felt that it had to be made. Some dust settled gently around him. Torag watched him with his dancing, glittering eyes. "I merely carry out the instructions given to me by your father," he said in a grotesque parody of obsequiousness.
"It seems to me," said Thor, "that the instructions my father has been giving since you entered his service have been very odd. I think you have some kind of evil grip on him. Don't know what kind of evil grip it is, but it's definitely a grip, and it's definitely..." Synonyms failed him. "Evil," he concluded. Torag reacted like an iguana to whom someone has just complained about the wine.
"Me?" he protested. "How can I possibly have a grip on your father? Odin is the greatest of the gods of Asgard, and I am his devoted servant in all things. Odin says, 'Do this, and I do it.' Odin says, 'Go there, and I go there.' Odin says, 'Go and get my big, stupid son out of hospital before he causes any more trouble, and then, I don't know, glue him to the floor or something. And I do exactly as he asks. I am merely the most humble of functionaries. However small or menial the task, Odin's bidding is what I am there to perform."
Thor was not sufficiently subtle a student of human nature, or for that matter divine or goblin nature, to be able to argue that this was in fact a very powerful grip to hold over anybody, particularly a fallible and pampered old god. He just knew that it was all wrong.
"Well then," he shouted, "take this message back to my father, Odin. Tell him that I, Thor, the god of thunder, demand to meet him. And not in his damned hospital either. I'm not going to hang around reading magazines and looking at fruit while he has his bed changed. Tell him that Thor, the god of thunder, will meet Odin, the father of the gods of Asgard, tonight at the challenging hour in the halls of Asgard."
"Again?" said Torag, with a sly glance sideways at the Coca-Cola vending machine.
Yes," said Thor. "Yes," he repeated in a rage. "Again!"
Torag made a tiny sigh, such as one who felt resigned to carrying out the bidding of a temperamental simpleton might make, and said, "Well, I'll tell him. I don't suppose he will be best pleased."
"It's no matter of yours whether he's pleased or not," shouted Thor, disturbing the foundations of the building once more. "This is between my father and myself. You may think yourself very clever, Torag, and you may think that I am not."
Torag arched an eyebrow. He had prepared for this moment. He stayed silent, and merely let the stray beam of sunlight glint on his dancing eyes. It was a silence of the most profound eloquence.
"I may not know what you're up to, Torag. I may not know a lot of things, but I do know one thing. I know that I am Thor, the god of thunder, and that I will not be made a fool of by a goblin."
"Well," said Torag, with a light grin, "when you know two things, I expect you'll be twice as clever. Remember to put your clothes on before you go out."
He gestured casually at the pile beside him, and departed.
The trouble with the sort of shop that sells things like magnifying glasses and penknives is that they tend also to sell all kinds of other fascinating things, like the quite extraordinary device with which Dirk eventually emerged, after having been hopelessly unable to decide between the knife with the built-in Phillips screwdriver, toothpick and ballpoint pen, and the one with the 13-tooth gristle saw and TIG-welded rivets. The magnifying glasses had held him in thrall for a short while, particularly the 25-diopter high-index vacuum-deposited gold-coated glass model with the integral handle and mount, and the notchless seal glazing. But then Dirk had happened to catch sight of a small, electronic I Ching calculator, and he was lost. He had never before even guessed at the existence of such a thing. And to be able to move from total ignorance of something to total desire for it, and then actually to own the thing, all within the space of about 40 seconds, was, for Dirk, something of an epiphany. The electronic I Ching calculator was badly made. It had probably been manufactured in whichever of the southeastern Asian countries was busy tooling up to do to South Korea what South Korea was busy doing to Japan. Glue technology had obviously not progressed in that country to the point where things could be successfully held together with it. Already the back had fallen off and needed to be stuck back on with scotch tape. It was much like an ordinary pocket calculator, except that the LCD screen was a little larger than usual, in order to accommodate the abridged judgments of King Wen on each of the 64 hexagrams, and also the commentaries of his son, the Duke of Chu, on each of the lines of each hexagram. These were unusual texts to see marching across the display of a pocket calculator, particularly as they had been translated from the Chinese via the Japanese, and seemed to have enjoyed many adventures on the way. The device also functioned as an ordinary calculator, but only to a limited degree. It could handle any calculation which returned an answer of anything up to 4. 1 plus 1 it could manage, 2, and 1 plus 2, 3, and 2 plus 2, 4, or tan 74, 3.4874145, but anything above 4 it represented merely as a suffusion of yellow. Dirk was not certain if this was a programming error or an insight beyond his ability to fathom. But he was crazy about it anyway, enough to hand over £20 of ready cash for the thing. "Thank you, sir," said the proprietor. "It's a nice piece, that. I think you'll be happy with it."
"I ab,"
said Dirk. "Glad to hear it, sir," replied the proprietor. "Do you know you've broken your nose?" Dirk looked up from fawning on his new possession. "Yet," he said testily, "of course I do." The man nodded, satisfied. "Just that a lot of my customers wouldn't always know about a thing like that," he explained. Dirk thanked him tersely and hurried out with his purchase. A few minutes later, he took up residence at the small corner table of an Islington cafe, ordered a small but incredibly strong cup of coffee, and attempted to take stock of his day. A moment's reflection told him that he was almost certainly going to need a small but incredibly strong beer as well, and he attempted to add this to his order. "A what?" said the waiter. His hair was very black and filled with brilliantine. He was tall, incredibly fit, and too cool to listen to customers or say consonants. Dirk repeated his order, but what with having the cafe's music system, a broken nose, and the waiter's insuperable cool to contend with, he eventually found it simpler to write out the order on a napkin with a stub of pencil. The waiter peered at it in an offended manner and left. Dirk exchanged a friendly nod with the girl sitting half reading a book at the next table, who had watched this exchange with sympathy. Then he set about laying out his morning's acquisitions on the table in front of him: the newspaper, the electronic I Ching calculator, and the envelope which he had retrieved from behind the gold disc on Geoffrey Anstey's bathroom wall. He then spent a minute or two dabbing at his nose with a handkerchief, and prodding it tenderly to see how much it hurt, which turned out to be quite a lot. He sighed and stuffed the handkerchief back in his pocket. A few seconds later, the waiter returned, bearing a herb omelette and a single breadstick. Dirk explained that this wasn't what he'd ordered. The waiter shrugged and said it wasn't his fault. Dirk had no idea what to say to this, and said so. He was still having a great deal of difficulty speaking. The waiter asked Dirk if he knew that he'd broken his nose, and Dirk said that, "Yes, thank you very much, he did." The waiter said that his friend Neil had once broken his nose, and Dirk said that he hoped it hurt like hell, which seemed to draw the conversation to a close. The waiter took the omelette and left, vowing never to return. When the girl sitting at the next table looked away for a moment, Dirk leaned over and took her coffee. He knew that he was perfectly safe doing this, because she would simply not be able to believe that this had happened. He sat sipping at the lukewarm cup and casting his mind back over the day. He knew that before consulting the I Ching, even an electronic one, he should try and compose his thoughts and allow them to settle calmly. This was a tough one. However much he tried to clear his mind and think in a calm and collected way, he was unable to stop Geoffrey Anstey's head revolving incessantly in his mind. It revolved disapprovingly, as if pointing an accusing finger at Dirk. The fact that it did not have an accusing finger with which to point only served to drive the point it was trying to make home all the harder. Dirk screwed up his eyes and attempted to concentrate instead on the problem of the mysteriously vanished Miss Pierce, but was unable to get much of a grip on it. When she had used to work for him, she would often disappear mysteriously for 2 or 3 days at a time, but the papers didn't make any kind of fuss about it then. Admittedly, there weren't things exploding around her at the time, at least not that he was aware of. She'd never mentioned anything exploding particularly. Furthermore, whenever he thought of her face, which he had last seen on the television set in Geoffrey Anstey's house, his thoughts tended instantly to sink towards the head, which was busy revolving 33 1/3 times a minute, 3 floors beneath it. This was not conducive to the calm and contemplative mood he was seeking, nor was the very loud music on the cafe's music system. He sighed and stared at the electronic I Ching calculator. If he wanted to get his thoughts into some kind of order, then maybe chronological order would be as good as any other. He decided to cast his mind back to the beginning of the day, before any of these appalling things had happened, or at least before they had happened to him. First, there had been the fridge. It seemed to him that, by comparison with everything else, the problem of what to do about his fridge had now shrunk to fairly manageable proportions. It still provoked a discernible twinge of fear and guilt, but here, he thought, was a problem which he could face up to with relative calm. The little book of instructions suggested that he should simply concentrate soulfully on the question which was besieging him. Write it down, ponder on it, enjoy the silence, and then once he had achieved inner harmony and tranquillity, he should push the red button. There wasn't a red button, but there was a blue button, marked red, and this Dirk took to be the one. He concentrated for a while on the question, then looked through his pockets for a piece of paper, but was unable to find one. In the end, he wrote his question, "Should I buy a new fridge?" on a corner of his napkin. Then he took the view that if he was going to wait until he had achieved inner harmony and tranquillity, he could be there all night. So he went ahead and pushed the blue button marked red anyway. A symbol flashed up in a corner of the screen, a hexagram labelled Number 3, Chun. The I Ching calculator then scrolled this text across its tiny LCD display: "The Judgment of King Wen. Chun signifies difficulties at outset, as of blade of grass pushing up against stone. The time is full of irregularities and obscurities. Superior man will adjust his measures as in sorting the threads of the warp and woof. Firm correctness will bring at last success. Early advances should only be made with caution. There will be advantage in appointing feudal princes. Line 6 changes. The commentary of the Duke of Chu. The horses and the chariots obliged to retreat. Streams of bloody tears will flow. Dirk considered this for a few moments, and then decided that on balance it appeared to be a vote in favour of getting the new fridge, which, by a staggering coincidence, was the course of action which he himself favoured. There was a payphone in one of the dark corners where waiters slouched moodily at one another. Dirk threaded his way through them, wondering whom it was they reminded him of, and eventually deciding that it was a small crowd of naked men standing around behind the Holy Family in Michelangelo's picture of that name, for no more apparent reason than that Michelangelo rather liked them. He telephoned an acquaintance of his, called Nobby Paxton, or so he claimed, who worked the darker side of the domestic appliance supply business. Dirk came straight to the point. "Nobby, I need a fridge." "Dirk, I've been saving one against the day you'd ask me." Dirk found this highly unlikely. "Only I want a good fridge, you see, Dobby." "This is the best, Dirk. Japanese, microprocessor-controlled." "What would the microprocessor be doing in a fridge, Dobby?" "Keeping itself cool, Dirk. I'll get the lads to bring it round right away. I need to get it off the premises pretty sharpish for reasons which I won't trouble you with." "I appreciate this, Dobby," said Dirk. "Problem is, I'm not at home at present." "Gaining access to houses in the absence of their owners is only one of the panoply of skills with which my lads are blessed. Let me know if you find anything missing afterwards, by the way."
"I'd be happy to, Dobby. In fact, if your lads are in the mood for carting stuff off, I'd be glad if they'd start with my old fridge. It badly needs throwing away."
"I'll say that it's done, Dirk. There's usually a skip or two in your street these days. Now, do you expect to be paying for this, or shall I just get your kneecap straight off, save everybody time and aggravation all round?"
It was never 100% clear to Dirk exactly when Nobby was joking, and he was not keen to put it to the test. He assured him that he would pay him as soon as they next met.
"See you very soon, then, Dirk," said Nobby. "By the way, do you know you sound exactly as if someone's broken your nose?"
There was a pause.
"You there, Dirk?" said Nobby.
"Yes," said Dirk. "I was just listening to a record."
"Hot potato!" roared the hi-fi in the cafe. "Don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it up. Quick, pass it on, pass it on, pass it on."
"I said, do you know you sound exactly as if someone's broken your nose?" repeated Nobby.
Dirk said that he did know this, thanked Nobby for pointing it out, said goodbye, stood thoughtfully for a moment, made another quick couple of phone calls, and then threaded his way back through the huddle opposing waiters to find the girl whose coffee he had appropriated, sitting at his table.
"Hello," she said meaningfully.
Dirk was as gracious as he knew how. He bowed to her very politely, doffed his hat, since all this gave him a second or so to recover himself, and requested her permission to sit down. "Go ahead," she said. "It's your table." She gestured magnanimously. She was small, her hair was neat and dark, she was in her mid-twenties, and she was looking quizzically at the half-empty cup of coffee in the middle of the table. Dirk sat down opposite her and leant forward conspiratorially. "I expect," he said in a low voice, "you are inquiring after your coffee."
"You betcha," said the girl.
"It's very bad for you, you know."
"Is it?"
"It is. Caffeine, cholesterol in the milk."
"I see, so it was just my health you were thinking of."
"I was thinking of many things," said Dirk airily.
"You saw me sitting at the next table and you thought, there's a nice-looking girl with her health in ruins, let me save her from herself.
In a nutshell.
Do you know you've broken your nose?"
"Yes, of course I do," said Dirk crossly. "Everybody keeps—"
"How long ago did you break it?" the girl asked.
"It was broken for me," said Dirk, "about 20 minutes ago."
"I thought so," said the girl. "Close your eyes for a moment."
Dirk looked at her suspiciously.
"Why?"
"It's all right," she said with a smile. "I'm not going to hurt you. Now close them." With a puzzled frown, Dirk closed his eyes just for a moment. In that moment, the girl reached over and gripped him firmly by the nose, giving it a sharp twist. Dirk nearly exploded with pain and howled so loudly that he almost attracted the attention of a waiter.
"You witch!" he yelled, staggering wildly back from the table, clutching his face. "You double-dabbed witch!"
"Oh, be quiet and sit down," she said. "All right, I lied about it not going to hurt you. But at least it should be straight now, which will save you a lot worse later on. You should go straight round to a hospital and have some splints and padding put in. I'm a nurse, I know what I'm doing. Or at least I think I do. Let's have a look at you."
Panting and spluttering, Dirk sat down once more, his hands cupped round his nose. After a few long seconds, he began to prod it tenderly again, and then let the girl examine it. She said, "My name's Sally Mills, by the way. I usually try to introduce myself properly before physical intimacy takes place, but sometimes," she sighed, "there just isn't time." Dirk ran his fingers up either side of his nose again.
"I think it is straighter," said Dirk at last.
"Straighter," Sally said. "Say straighter properly. It'll help you feel better."
"Straighter," said Dirk.
"Yet I see what you mean."
"What?"
"I see what you mean."
"Good," she said with a sigh of relief.
"I'm glad that worked. My horoscope this morning said that virtually everything I decided today would be wrong."
"Yes, well, you don't want to believe all that rubbish," said Dirk sharply. "I don't," said Sally. "Particularly not the great Zaganza."
"Oh, you read it too, did you?"
"No, that is, well, not for the same reason."
"My reason was that a patient asked me to read his horoscope to him this morning, just before he died. What was yours?"
"A very complicated one."
"I see," said Sally sceptically. "What's this?"
"It's a calculator," said Dirk. "Well, look, I mustn't keep you. I'm indebted to you, my dear lady, for the tenderness of your ministrations and the loan of your coffee, but lo, the day wears on, and I'm sure you have a heavy schedule of grievous bodily harm to attend to."
"Not at all. I came off night duty at 9 o'clock this morning, and all I have to do all day is keep awake so that I can sleep normally tonight. I have nothing better to do than sit around talking to strangers in cafes. You, on the other hand, should get yourself to a casualty department as soon as possible. As soon as you've paid my bill, in fact." She leant over to the table she'd originally been sitting at and picked up the running total lying by her plate. She looked at it, shaking her head disapprovingly. 5 cups of coffee, I'm afraid. It was a long night on the wards, all sorts of comings and goings in the middle of it. One patient in a coma had to be moved to a private hospital in the early hours. God knows why it had to be done at that time of night. It just creates unnecessary trouble. I wouldn't pay for the second croissant if I were you. I ordered it, but it never came." She pushed the bill across to Dirk, who picked it up with a reluctant sigh.
"Inordinate," he said. "Larcenously inordinate. And in the circumstances, adding a 15% service charge is tantamount to jeering at you. I bet they won't even bring me a knife." He turned, and tried, without any real hope of success, to summon any of the gaggle of waiters lounging among the sugar bowls at the back. Sally Mills took her bill and Dirk's and attempted to add them up on Dirk's calculator. "The total seems to come to a suffusion of yellow," she said. "Thank you, I'll take that," said Dirk, turning back crossly and relieving her of the electronic I Ching set, which he put into his pocket. He resumed his hapless waving at the tableau of waiters. "What do you want a knife for, anyway?" asked Sally. "To open this," said Dirk, waggling the large, heavily scotch-taped envelope at her. "I'll get you one," she said. A young man sitting on his own at another nearby table was looking away at that moment, so Sally quickly leaned across and nabbed his knife. "I am indebted to you," said Dirk, and put out his hand to take the knife from her. She held it away from him. "What's in the envelope?" she said.
"You are an extremely inquisitive and presumptuous young lady," exclaimed Dirk.
"And you," said Sally Mills, "are very strange."
"Only," said Dirk, "as strange as I need to be."
"Hm," said Sally. "What's in the envelope?" She still wouldn't give him the knife.
"The envelope is not yours," proclaimed Dirk, "and its contents are not your concern."
"Looks very interesting, though. What's in it?"
"Well, I won't know till I've opened it."
She looked at him suspiciously, then snatched the envelope from him.
"I insist that you—"
expostulated Dirk incompletely.
"What's your name?" demanded Sally.
"My name is Gently, Mr. Dirk Gently."
"And not Geoffrey Anstey or any of these other names that have been crossed out?"
She frowned briefly, looking at them.
"No," said Dirk, "certainly not."
"So you mean the envelope is not yours, either?"
"I... that is..."
"Aha!
So you are also being extremely... what was it?"
"Inquisitive and presumptuous. I do not deny it, but I am a private detective. I am paid to be inquisitive and presumptuous. Not as often or copiously as I would wish, but I am nevertheless inquisitive and presumptuous on a professional basis."
"How sad. I think it's much more fun being inquisitive and presumptuous as a hobby. So you are a professional, while I am merely an amateur of Olympic standard. You don't look like a private detective."
"No private detective looks like a private detective. That's one of the first rules of private detection."
"But if no private detective looks like a private detective, how does a private detective know what it is he's supposed not to look like? Seems to me there's a problem there."
"Yes, but it's not one that keeps me awake at night," said Dirk in exasperation. "Anyway, I am not as other private detectives. My methods are holistic, and in a very proper sense of the word, chaotic. I operate by investigating the fundamental interconnectedness of all things."
Sally Mills merely blinked at him.
"Every particle in the universe," continued Dirk, warming to his subject and beginning to stare a bit, "affects every other particle, however faintly or obliquely. Everything interconnects with everything. The beating of a butterfly's wings in China can affect the course of an Atlantic hurricane. If I could interrogate this table leg in a way that made sense to me or to the table leg, then it could provide me with the answer to any question about the universe. I could ask anybody I liked, chosen entirely by chance, any random question I cared to think of, and their answer, or lack of it, would in some way bear upon the problem to which I am seeking a solution. It's only a question of knowing how to interpret it. Even you, whom I have met entirely by chance, probably know things that are vital to my investigation. If only I knew what to ask you, which I don't, and if only I could be bothered to, which I can't." He paused and said, "Please will you let me have the envelope and the knife?"
"You make it sound as if someone's life depends on it."
Dirk dropped his eyes for a moment. "I rather think somebody's life did depend on it," he said. He said it in such a way that a cloud seemed to pass briefly over them. Sally Mills relented and passed the envelope and the knife over to Dirk. A spark seemed to go out of her. The knife was too blunt and the scotch tape too thickly applied. Dirk struggled with it for a few seconds, but was unable to slice through it. He sat back in his seat, feeling tired and irritable. He said, "I'll go and ask them if they've got anything sharper," and stood up, clutching the envelope. "You should go and get your nose fixed," said Sally Mills quietly. "Thank you," said Dirk, and bowed very slightly to her. He picked up the bills and set out to visit the exhibition of waiters mounted at the rear of the cafe. He encountered a certain coolness when he was disinclined to augment the mandatory 15% service charge with any voluntary additional token of his personal appreciation, and was told that, no, that was the only type of knife they had, and that's all there was to it. Dirk thanked them and walked back through the cafe. Sitting in his seat, talking to Sally Mills, was the young man whose knife she had purloined. He nodded to her, but she was deeply engrossed in conversation with her new friend and did not notice. "In a coma," she was saying, "who had to be moved to a private hospital in the early hours. God knows why it had to be done at that time of night. Just creates unnecessary trouble. Excuse me rabbiting on, but the patient had his own personal Coca-Cola machine and sledgehammer with him, and that sort of thing is all very well in a private hospital. But on a short-staffed NHS ward, it just makes me tired, and I talk too much when I'm tired. If I suddenly fall insensible to the floor, would you let me know?" Dirk walked on, and then noticed that Sally Mills had left the book she had been reading on her original table, and something about it caught his attention. It was a large book called Run Like the Devil. In fact, it was extremely large and a little dog-eared, looking more like a puff pastry cliff than a book. The bottom half of the cover featured the normal woman in cocktail dress framed in the sights of a gun, while the upper half was entirely taken up with the author's name, Howard Bell, embossed in silver. Dirk couldn't immediately work out what it was about the book that had caught his eye, but he knew that some detail of the cover had struck a chord with him somewhere. He gave a circumspect glance at the girl whose coffee he had purloined, and whose 5 coffees and 2 croissants, one undelivered and uneaten, he had subsequently paid for. She wasn't looking, so he purloined her book as well, and slipped it into the pocket of his leather coat. He stepped out onto the street, where a passing eagle swooped out of the sky at him, nearly forcing him into the path of a cyclist, who cursed and swore at him from the moral high ground that cyclists alone seem able to inhabit. Into the well-kempt grounds that lay just on the outskirts of a well-kempt village on the fringes of the well-kempt Cotswolds turned a less than well-kempt car. It was a battered yellow Citroën 2CV, which had had one careful owner, but also 3 suicidally reckless ones. It made its way up the driveway with a reluctant air, as if all it asked for from life was to be tipped into a restful ditch in one of the adjoining meadows, and there allowed to settle in graceful abandonment, instead of which here it was being asked to drag itself all the way up this long gravelled drive, which it would no doubt soon be called upon to drag itself all the way back down again to what possible purpose it was beyond its wits to imagine. It drew to a halt in front of the elegant stone entrance to the main building, and then began to trundle slowly backwards again until its occupant yanked on the handbrake, which evoked from the car a sort of strangled eek. A door flopped open, wobbling perilously on its one remaining hinge, and there emerged from the car a pair of the sort of legs which soundtrack editors are unable to see without needing to slap a smoky saxophone solo all over it, for reasons which no one besides soundtrack editors has ever been able to understand. The owner of the legs followed them in the usual manner, closed the car door tenderly, and then made her way into the building. The car remained parked in front of it. After a few minutes, a porter came out and examined it, adopted a disapproving manner, and then, for lack of anything more positive to do, went back in. A short time later, Kate was shown into the office of Mr. Ralph Standish, the chief consultant psychologist and one of the directors of the Woodshead Hospital, who was just completing a telephone conversation. "Yes, it is true," he was saying, "that sometimes unusually intelligent and sensitive children can appear to be stupid. But, Mrs. Benson, stupid children can sometimes appear to be stupid as well. I think that's something you might have to consider. I know it's very painful. Yes. Good day, Mrs. Benson." He put the phone away into a desk drawer and spent a couple of seconds collecting his thoughts before looking up. "This is very short notice, Miss, Schechter," he said to her at last. In fact, what he said was, "This is very short notice, Miss, And then he had paused and peered into another of his desk drawers before saying Schechter. It seemed to Kate that it was very odd to keep your visitors' names in a drawer, but then he clearly disliked having things cluttering up his fine but severely designed black ash desk, because there was nothing on it at all. It was completely blank, as was every other surface in his office. There was nothing on the small, neat steel and glass coffee table which sat squarely between 2 Barcelona chairs. There was nothing on top of the 2 expensive-looking filing cabinets which stood at the back of the room. There were no bookshelves. If there were any books, they were presumably hidden away behind the white doors of the large, blank, built-in cupboards. And although there was one plain black picture frame hanging on the wall, this was presumably a temporary aberration, because there was no picture in it." Kate looked around her with a bemused air. "Do you have no ornaments in here at all, Mr. Standish?" she asked.
He was for a moment somewhat taken aback by her transatlantic directness, but then answered her. "Indeed I have ornaments," he said, and pulled open another drawer. He pulled out from this a small china model of a kitten playing with a ball of wool, and put it firmly on the desk in front of him. "As a psychologist, I am aware of the important role that ornamentation plays in nourishing the human spirit," he pronounced. He put the china kitten back in the drawer and slid it closed with a smooth click. "Now," he clasped his hands together on the desk in front of him and looked at her inquiringly. "It's very good of you to see me at short notice, Mr. Standish. Yes, yes, we've established that. But I'm sure you know what newspaper deadlines are like." "I know at least as much as I would ever care to know about newspapers, Miss, he opened his drawer again. Miss Schechter, but..." "Well, that's partly what made me approach you," lied Kate charmingly. "I know that you have suffered from some, unfortunate publicity here, and thought you might welcome the opportunity to talk about some of the more enlightening aspects of the work at the Woodshead Hospital." She smiled very sweetly.